Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm Alan Cardoza, and I was all set to have back my co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek, but unfortunately, his daughter is not feeling well, so he's doing the right thing as a parent. He's staying home, and he's taking care of her. Now, for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, we both thank you so much. It is so much appreciated. And please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to making your lives happier, healthier, and more successful. Now, this show will introduce you to talented authors, caring people, and new innovations in the areas of health, security, and fun for your family. And with our experience working with families in crisis, we've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, if you're beginning to experience parental burnout, those of you parents that have children who are starting to reach that age, and you're concerned about your teen or your tween, and you're starting to think that maybe they're going in the wrong direction, and your best efforts to help them or her are not solving the problem, please stay with us as we discuss the steps to ending the parent-teen control battle. Now, joining us today on this topic is Neil Brown, who shares that he discovered something amazing as a teacher when he drove out to students' rural homes and met with their parents. He told the parents how much he enjoyed their kids. And what he realized was it created a profound difference in how the children performed. Many went from being defeated or depressed or unmotivated students to happy and engaged kids. Now, after receiving his master's in social work at the University of Denver, Neil describes himself as a virtual family therapy addict, going to seminar after seminar and reading stacks of books on family therapy. And all this studying about family dynamics and its influence on individual development forced Neil to look at himself and the family in which he grew up, learning how important relationship and communication patterns are and the huge impact they have on personality development. His first book, entitled Ending the Parent-Teen Control Battle, is just one of the powerful tools he has developed to help families. Now, he writes an impressive and popular blog and appears on radio and other media frequently around the country. Neil, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you, Alan. It's so nice to be here, and thank you for that lovely introduction. It's great.
Well, I had a chance to go into the book, and I love the fact that you wrote this sort of as something that everybody could sit down and read. And I felt like it really didn't matter if your children were acting out. It didn't matter if your children were maybe starting to be a little more rebellious. It just really talked about why we all need to improve our communication, not only with our children, but with everybody.
Well, that's a lot of the feedback I've gotten. I've had people read the book who aren't raising kids, and they've all said that it's given them a good look in the mirror and some good inspiration for new ideas for going forward.
Well, that's certainly the impact that I got from it. So let's talk a little bit about the book. And at what point did you say to yourself, okay, I've now been in practice, I've now been helping a lot of families, I think I need to reach more people. I'm going to now sit down and put this all in paper.
Well, that's an excellent question. And what happened was I was just doing my thing of being a psychotherapist in my office. And one of my clients was a school administrator. And she said, would you please come to our middle school and talk to our parents about all the things that you talked with me about? And I said, well, I'm a psychotherapist. I'm not a speaker. What I say to one person is just relevant to that particular situation. And she said, oh, no, it's not. Everything you're talking about, all these parents need to hear that. So I said, okay. So I made some notes on all the things I thought were important for parents to know about, and I gave the talk. And then I started doing that on a regular basis for their school. And then one time after giving my talk, someone said, have you ever considered writing a book about this? I said, well, no. I have ADD. I have dyslexia. I can't write, and I'm not a writer. She said, well, I'm a publisher. I could help you. So she gave me an editor, and we met on a weekly basis, and I started to structure the book out. And then I got pretty busy, and I think there was the first recession, the dot-com bust, and she lost some of her resources, and I started working actually in industry, working with companies doing team development, and then came back to the book a number of years later and, you know, found a new publisher and started going, and it just was there in me and I needed to get it out. So it just kind of evolved organically in that way.
And at what point did you decide that the term control battle was something that was going to be powerful in the title?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know if I have a good answer for it, Alan. It was just what was really going on in virtually every situation I was working with, particularly those that had to do with teenagers, was that there was a parent trying to get a kid to move in a certain direction, and they were meeting resistance of one form or another at virtually every turn. And so it just had that feel of that's what it is. It's a control battle, and which is different from, you know, the normal clashes that parents and teens have under normal circumstances. You know, though, parents and any two people are going to disagree at a certain point, but parents and teens have a dynamic relationship. Kids are becoming independent, and so they're shifting in their accountability and their responsibility from their parents, which is very strong early in adolescence, to more self-directed accountability and responsibility later in adolescence. So that dynamic process of moving from strict accountability to self-accountability is one that, you know, invites a lot of arguments and misunderstandings, where one kid thinks that they own autonomy over a certain decision and another parent may not just think that's the case. So those clashes are going to happen. But with a control battle, those clashes never get resolved, and it just becomes a interactional pattern that begins to define the relationship and keeps progress from being able to move forward and keeps that transition from going smoothly or often going at all.
Well, and when I read it, and that was one of the things that I noticed, and I liked it because I realized that with many of the families that we work with, and when we're transporting their at-risk child to a specialized sure. program, and we're doing the history, and many of the parents say that it's a never-ending battle. You know, when we talk, you know, what are the issues you're going over with your child? You know, what are their likes? What are their dislikes? And that term, never-ending battle, has been used thousands of times with us. So when I saw the title of the book and I went, wow, that's exactly what a lot of parents are saying. This is a never-ending control battle. So I think you were really tapping into something, you know, when you decided that that was going to be the title. Now, I know in going through the book, you talk about the three drivers, and these are the drivers that cause and support this control battle. Share with our listeners what these are.
Sure. Well, one is reactivity. In other words, you know, your kid says something, and then you react, and they might say something that you don't like hearing, and then it's normal and common for us to react to that. Hey, don't talk to me that way, or hey, don't do that, or knock that off, or clean that up. And you just creates a climate where now the kid is setting the stage and now the parent is reacting to it. So there's a lack of authority and thoughtfulness and engagement in the way the parent would normally like to proceed. Now they are giving their power away, in a sense, to their teenager who now is leading the way, and now parents are reacting to the way. So when we are in react mode, we're giving away our power. And when kids have the power and parents don't, well, you could understand how that becomes a formula for problems. And the second way is simply having a negative tone. And a negative tone is certainly common if you're trying to set a limit. And, you know, and it's not always a bad thing. Sometimes it's a way to communicate that this is not okay. But once we get into a control battle, the negative tone just tends to drive it. And it sends the message to a kid, I'm against you. Mm-hmm. And if you think someone is against you, what are you going to do? You're going to defend. So now that becomes another driver in the control battle pattern. And then the third element is what I call being other person focused. And so what happens when we're other person focused is we're trying to change our kid or change their behavior. And think about it. Whenever someone tries to change us or change our behavior, our natural tendency is to be defensive and to resist that effort to create change in us. So the person that can really change a kid is the kid. Mm-hmm. So if you're trying to change Joey, you're doing Joey's job. Joey needs to be the guy who chooses and decides to change his own behavior. So what parents can do is they can set up the culture or the structure whereby Joey can make his own choices, but when they try to control Joey, what they're going to invoke is Joey's resistance. So those three things seem to be the things that tend to invite control battles most commonly.
Now, many of the parents that have probably chosen to listen to this show or have chosen to go out and buy the book, they're probably already in this battle. Okay, they're already in a control battle, so they're probably saying to themselves right now, okay, but I'm trying to communicate, and if they're doing something that is drastically negative or something that is potentially very damaging to them, such as, you know, illicit drugs or something, in their mind, they're thinking, you know, I don't have time to wait and see if they're going to change. I'm a parent. This is my parental role, and I need to make this change. So what do you say to those that have already gotten partway into this issue? How do they deal with that?
Well, you're asking a really important question because there's so many other cues in our culture that say parents are responsible for their kids' behavior. So, for instance, if your kid commits a crime, you know, you're going to be the one who has to take responsibility for it. If your kid won't go to school, then you can be considered a negligent parent. So there are lots of cues in our culture that say we are responsible for our children's behavior. And then once a family is now involved in a control battle pattern, then yes, they're gonna be almost addicted to trying to keep a kid from doing a dangerous behavior because, you know, their kid could be at risk, and that's an area of expertise of yours, Alan. When kids are cutting or they're running away, or they're in toxicity level with substance abuse, and so parents are gonna want to make a change. And sometimes in drastic situations like that, there needs to be a severe intervention that will make a kid safe. But short of that, what I'll have to tell parents is, as long as we're in this paradigm of you trying to take control, what we're really doing is their job, and they're not going to take control. And we need to change this paradigm where now instead of you taking responsibility, now they do. So here's the catch. Very often, parents are trying to manage their kids' behavior in one way or another, and yet their kids are enjoying privileges that really haven't earned. And parents are taking away things as a way to try to teach them a lesson or control them, but they shouldn't be having those things in really the first place. So in a sense, very often parents are being overindulgent on the front end and then over-controlling on the back end. And what I'll advise parents is this two-step process. One is, rather than being negative and being upset about your child's behavior, stay positive, stay connected with them, and let them know that you believe in their best self. That's step number one. Step number two is make sure they understand that in order for them to enjoy the privileges that they're currently enjoying, they're going to have to now earn them. So they might be losing all their privileges. So cell phones and computer access and free time and going out and social media and all that stuff, money, can all just go away very quickly, but not punitively, in the sense saying, look, I've let you down. I really haven't asked enough of you. And I apologize for that. I'll take responsibility for my parenting. I have been indulgent, and you now are enjoying things that you shouldn't be enjoying because you haven't earned them. And so rather than me trying to take it away as teaching you a lesson, I'm going to let you earn them. But you're not going to get off until you're not going to get them until you earn them. And then you're going to need to earn them in essentially two ways. You're going to need to have a good attitude that demonstrates respect and cooperation, and you're going to need to give your responsibilities your best effort. And if you're doing those two things, hey, I'm with you. I'm with you anyway, but I'm with you with privileges when you step out into that arena. So that's the way I try to, that's the way I'll help a family when they're already in their negative pattern.
Now, it makes perfect sense. And we have a message coming in from a listener. And again, I want to thank everybody when they take the time to do this. And this seems to be right on topic. It says, my friend's daughter is the typical teen manipulator, to the point she now presents herself as the parent and talks down to her mother. Her mom becomes so frustrated that she backs off from disciplining her when her daughter rides off the rail. 3 months ago, she was caught drinking outside their courtyard. Her mother, rather than impose restrictions, makes excuses. My friend is such a loving person, and I do so wish to help her. What advice would you give her, and would your book be of help to her? And this is from Beth in Los Angeles.
Well, Beth, I can't appreciate your question anymore. I mean, that's exactly on target. And unfortunately, I think you're feeling the mother's pain more than the mother's willing to take action to help herself. But you're absolutely right. This book will help that mother understand that she's not doing her daughter any favors by not taking action. In order for kids to grow and develop, they really do need that structure, and they have to learn to engage healthy behavior. They need pro-social, healthy choices and behaviors and activities. And if they're not going in that direction, well, by the time this girl, I don't know how old she is, by the time she hits 18, 19, and she's ready to move forward in her life, she's not going to have the skill set of understanding how the world really works, how to set limits for herself in reasonable ways, how to cooperate, how to be respectful, how to be thoughtful. So mom's not really doing her any favors by not creating a structure and having accountability. And kids do need to have accountability to their parents. Like I said earlier, it's that transition from strict teen accountability to parents to teen accountability to self and responsibility for self, that's something that takes place in a stepwise kind of fashion. And if it's not taking place, then the learning and growth isn't taking place. And then when a kid gets into their young adulthood, they will not be prepared for it. And that's a whole nother radio show for us, Alan, yeah. Is, you know, young adults who are not launching successfully.
Exactly. Now, in this situation, it appears as though this is a single parent situation. How much more difficult do you think it is for a single parent to handle a situation like this? And do you provide different advice to them when it is a single parent trying to focus on this child?
Good question. I almost have to be a statistician and have some numbers in front of me. But I would say that there are many, many single parents that do excellently, and their children do just fine. So it's not to say that if you're a single parent that your road forward is impossible. it might be very possible. As a matter of fact, it is very possible, and I'll say that unequivocally. You know, sometimes if you're a single parent, it hasn't been easy for you all along. And perhaps there was a divorce, and perhaps it was a divorce with a parent that didn't stick around. Or maybe there was a parent or a father who never got involved. And maybe you're very under-resourced and you don't have family to help or support. And, you know, there was some trauma early on, and, you know, there was fighting in the home before the divorce happened and they left. And so it's very easy for there to be some really difficult things to overcome. That's number one. Mm-hmm. And number two is parents will often feel guilty about what they put their kid through, or feel guilty that she doesn't have a father, or feel guilty that there was fighting and arguing in the family previously, or feel guilty that she's not home as much to parent as she wants to because she needs to work. You know, but then her guilt starts to be the driver that doesn't allow her to set limits and ask the best of her child. But it's so important that what we ask of our children is their best. We want our fabulous kids to show up. We want their best to come out. And if our guilt is in the way, or our fear is in the way of our kids emerging their wonderful, beautiful selves, then we're not doing them any service, and we're not helping ourselves either, because right now that woman lives in a very stressful, unpleasant environment with her daughter being disrespectful and acting out. That's going to make the mom's life even worse.
Yeah, and in that situation, and where Beth refers to the teen as being a manipulator, when it comes to responsibilities, I think one of the things that a lot of parents struggle with is that on the one hand, they're trying to give their child responsibilities, and yet on the other hand, the child may be saying, well, you know, I'm not ready for those responsibilities, but I only want to take on these. So yes, I want the responsibility of the car, but I don't want the responsibility of getting good grades. So at what point do you think that children or teens are ready for which type of responsibilities, or how do you dole out more responsibilities?
Well, you know, that really is a great question, and I'm not sure I've got great generic answers for it. But let me offer this, Alan. If a kid is in a ongoing chronic control battle, so let's just say they're not doing great in school, but they're not doing great in school isn't so much a matter of fighting with their parents or avoiding responsibility. It's a matter of perhaps time management, not getting it all together the way they should or could, needing to work and improve in that area, knowing they need to work and improve in that area. But is it essentially a good, reliable, and responsible kid who is cooperative and takes responsibility? Well, there wouldn't be any reason to say that kid, well, if you're not getting a 3.5, you can't drive. That seems to me to be too arbitrary, because the kid's doing well in lots of areas and maybe needs some support and structure, and he needs to shore that up. If, on the other hand, we have a kid whose attitude is bad and they're not being accountable, and there isn't the sense of what my parents expect of me is what I expect of me, well, then that kid needs to perhaps, that's not a kid who you're going to give a lot of privileges to.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That kid, you know, even if they are getting by in school, unless they've got a much healthier attitude, I wouldn't be trusting that kid with a lot of independence and a lot of resources.
All right. So what are some good examples of the kind of earned privileges and responsibilities that kids and parents should be working towards?
Well, that's an excellent question. And it really, what those privileges really mean are a lot of independent decision making. So, for instance, you know, you're not going to hear from your 14-year-old, see you later, mom, I'm going out. What do you mean you're going out? We got to talk about this. Where you going, who you going with, and you don't have permission. This is something that we need to talk about. On the other hand, your 17-year-old, and they say to you, see you later, mom, going out. Okay, have a nice time. When are you coming home? That happens in lots of families, because our 17-year-old has grown and developed and now has the respect of their parent as a kid who makes good decisions and certainly has the privilege of choosing how and where they're going to be.
Right. And what I hear you saying is that they've earned that privilege. They didn't just get it because they happened to have turned 17.
No, there's plenty of 17-year-olds that should not have that should not have that privilege. And you're absolutely right, Alan. When they, in order to have a privilege, it has to be earned. It's not by birthright or by age right.
All right. Yeah. Okay, so for everybody, we are going to take a break. But again, we will be right back. Please stay with us as you are listening to Answers for the Family. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Our guest today is Neil Brown, and we're talking about his book, Ending the Parent-Teen Control Battle. So, Neil, in going through the book, you talked about two powerful tools that end the control battle. Share with us a little bit about those.
Thanks, Alan. Number one is to reclaim a healthy vision of the kid. What happens in control battles are that they become such an emotional struggle that our emotions start to change our thinking, and we start to believe in the negative idea of who our kid is. We start to write a negative story. They're disrespectful. They're lazy. They're, they're irresponsible. They're manipulative. Well, I'm not gonna do that. My kid is manipulative. And so they start to get all these negative narratives going. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, now they're responding to, now they're caught up in, that supports being caught up in the negative cycle itself, because now we've got a negative narrative that's controlling us. Our vision is controlling us, and we're acting against that negative vision. So step one is to remember the wonderful qualities that we know and love about our kid, and we should sit down and write them down. And I'll often have parents do that. I've had parents tell me all the bad behaviors and the bad things about their kid, and I'll say, okay, well, tell me about their good qualities. And suddenly their affect will change, their facial expression will change, their tone will change, and they'll light up and they'll start to talk about all the wonderful things that their kid is over the years. And then I remind them, that's who your kid really is, and you guys are fighting right now, so you're not seeing that, but let's remember who our kid is, and if you're not letting them know that that's who they are, they might forget that they're that kid too. So let's start with that. So number one is reclaiming a healthy vision of our teen. The second one is moving from the concept of consequences to the concept of earned privileges. And this is an important concept, because consequences are something that parents do to kids to teach them a lesson. And in all fairness, in non-control battle-based relationships, if a kid is doing something wrong and you give them a consequence, they get the message, oh, I guess I'm not supposed to do that. I kind of messed up and I won't do that anymore. And the consequence works just fine. But in a control battle-based relationship, the consequence becomes interpreted by the kid as my parent being A, unfair, and doing something to me, trying to get me to change my behavior, and then that adds to their resistance. And so rather than let that be the case, that's when we go to the concept of earned privileges. And once again, the privilege of electronics or free time, devices, use of the car, money, allowances, all that stuff. That those are things that kids earn by virtue of their being respectful and responsible. And if they have those things in place, then they can earn privileges. So those are the two turnarounds on the control battle.
Yeah, and I love that. And it's something that I brought up because you do talk about it in the book. And for everybody to just think about it, it really comes down to communication and privilege. And in regards to the first part, if you have communication and if you're focusing on gratitude, that means that you're sharing with them constantly what you're grateful for about them. And you have started to plant that attitude of gratitude in them. And in the concept of communication for privileges, communicate ahead of time. If you set it up ahead of time and you've said that the consequence for this action is A, and if you lie about that action, it's A doubled, then when they commit that action, they know because you've communicated ahead of time. And I think that's another thing that you touch on in the book that I think is really important for people to understand.
Well, that's really well put, Alan. I think making sure that kids understand what the deal is and what their path forward is. It's not that we're setting out, here's all the sand traps so that we can get you. We're saying, here's the ways for you to succeed. And we're on your side. We want you to succeed. We want you to have privileges. We want you to be happy. Matter of fact, that's what nothing more that a parent wants than a happy, successful kid. That's all we want. So we're on your side. We want you to have these privileges. What you have to do is put us in the driver's seat so that we can, in all good conscience, let you have them.
I love it. It's very well put. Now, share a little bit with our listeners about something you touch on in the book. Share about the beast.
Okay. Well, thanks for asking that. It's a very important idea because when... You know, I'm a family therapist by training and by passion. And so what do family therapists do? They look at patterns and choreographies, another way to say it, choreography within the family or patterns of behavior within the family. And when we have a negative pattern that's actually not working, that can be complex choreographies with several people involved, or it can just be a two-person control battle. But once we get that negative choreography, I like to personify it and not let, and so that helps the family members focus on the pattern of behavior rather than on each other. And I help them realize that it's the pattern that's defeating them. It's not each other that is defeating them. It's not your kid that's misbehaving. It's the pattern in the family that's encouraging your kid's misbehavior and your ill-advised parenting approach. So let's all look at the beast. Let's call it a beast, and we'll personify it, and we'll let it be another entity in the family. And then we'll ask ourselves, what are the behaviors that we're each doing that feed the beast? So now we can look at it and we can say, oh, I guess when I use a negative tone, or I get all upset when my kid does this, or I take it personally when my kid does this, those are my beast feeding behaviors. And then the kids say, well, I guess I feed the beast when I give my dad attitude when he asks me to do something. I'm going to do it anyway, so when I give him attitude, that feeds the beast. I don't have to feed the beast, and then I'm going to get more privileges. So everyone starts to realize what they're doing that feeds the negative pattern or feeds the control battle. And by personifying it and calling it a beast, actually it makes it kind of a game in the family. Mm-hmm. It adds some levity, and if you're working with kids or teens, you actually need a sense of humor and you need some things to laugh about and enjoy. And if you're going to give kids advice, it can't come, you know, with a stern, horrible voice. It needs to come with encouragement and some fun. And so personifying the control battle is a great way to depersonalize the problem and have a good time solving the problem.
Yeah, I love the way that you present that. And again, that's why I asked, because I love the way it's presented in the book, is there is no blame. You know, we're not blaming somebody for this, and we're actually taking responsibility. And I just think it's an excellent way for any of us, because we all have conflict in our life at some level. So, yeah, I saw it as something that was just a really good way to elicit conversation with your kids on subjects that sometimes aren't the most fun to talk about. But by doing it this way, without the blame, it really brings it out in the open, allows them to talk about it, and at the same time diffuses it. So I thank you for that. I really acknowledge you for putting something in a way that I think most any family can benefit from.
Thanks, Alan. I really enjoy that I got there. I can't remember exactly how I got there, but I think what I think happened. I think I've been so focused on looking at patterns in families for so many years that it has kind of become visual to me, and I at one point I started to decide that these patterns that I could almost see and touch and feel in the room actually had a presence and actually was a thing. So after so many years of just focusing on it, I decided to make it a thing. And I called it the beast so that now the parents could see what it was that I was seeing.
Exactly. You know, one of the things that I think anybody that listens to this show has commented about is they love to hear the success stories. So, and again, I realize you can't use any names, and we don't expect you to, but share with us a couple of success stories. And one of the reasons I bring this up is that there are many families that we encounter that when they tell me their story, they tell it in a way in which they believe they're the only one going through this. And I get messages back from parents that when they hear one of the success stories and they go, wow, that's what we're going through. So if you can share some, they can not only hear something that lets them know that they're not alone, but they can also see, wow, here's a path to correcting it and to all of us feeling much better about it.
Yeah. Well, okay, I'd be happy to. Before we end, though, be sure to ask me about the gap. And I'll answer that question later. But okay. Let me answer this question now. I was working with a family with a high school freshman who had a diagnosis of ADHD. And he was doing okay in school, not killing it, but he was doing okay in school. And he was using up all the family's energy at home. This mess, that mess. Eating things out of the refrigerator that he was explicitly told not to eat, doing things he shouldn't be doing, and his parents were constantly correcting him. And he was constantly feeling bad about it, but then his impulsivity and his distractibility would lead to the next mess that he would make that he would then be apologetic for, half apologetic, and then resistant to. And quite frankly, his self-esteem was lower than a grasshopper's knee. And so, you know, when I asked him what his plans were for the future, he gave me some sort of blue-collar job that sounded fine. I mean, if that was his passion, that'd be just fine. But I was confused. It really didn't sound like a passion to me. And we did some work in the family, and I began to help this family understand that ADHD does not mean it's not a permission slip from your pediatrician that you get to act out and not take responsibility. It's a way of understanding some of your own personal dynamics, and it might be challenging for him to learn to make some changes and to hold himself accountable and for his parents to hold him accountable. But it's not a death sentence. It's not a permission slip to act out. And so his parents and he started working together to improve his performance both at home and at school. And I helped them understand that you can actually change brain patterns and reduce the impact of ADHD by learning focus and learning self-control and really build those neural connections that are so important. And so they started working with that, and we had this beast, and the parents needed to look at what they were doing that fed the beast, and the boy had to consider what he was doing that fed the beast. And lo and behold, his grades went up, his social behavior improved enormously, his behavior in the home improved enormously, and instead of him being the perennial problem in the home, the parents got to focus on other issues in terms of family dynamics and their own needs and personal growth needs and career issues. And little by little, things moved into a much healthier place. And when I finally asked in the final session with this family what this boy's plans are for the future, there was no doubt about that he was going to college. Mm-hmm. And that was his passion.
So that was
an example of how we starved that beast.
And one of the things that I heard in there when you talked about the fact that he was taking up all of the attention. In other words, there was so much going on, and it was negative, but it was still out there, and he was taking up so much of the time and all of the energy out of the room. Share a little bit as to how that may affect the other children in a family, because I think that's something that a lot of parents don't realize is that with all of the time and effort and energy going towards this child that's acting out, what's going on with the other kids that are doing what they're supposed to do? At what point do they look at it and say, well, wait a minute, do I need to be acting out just to get somebody to pay attention?
Well, that's exactly right. That's one thing that happens, and sometimes that is what happens. Other times kids will see what's going on, and they'll decide that they have to be the good kid because this kid is burning out the family's resources. So they sacrifice some of their own needs and some of their own carefree childhood thinking and consciousness and devote themselves to making everybody okay all the time. Some kids will just become more invisible and decide that their needs and feelings don't matter. You know, that was actually the dynamic that was taking place in my family as a boy growing up in New Jersey. My father and my brother had a whopper of a control battle that went on virtually all the time. And I couldn't keep up with it. I didn't know what my role or my place in the family was. I became the good kid, much at the expense of my self-esteem and my sense of importance. And it took me a long time growing into my 20s and 30s to reclaim a healthy identity for myself after experiencing, you know, that diminished role for myself in my own family. Mm-hmm. So I know from personal experience that it does take a big toll and creates a lot of collateral damage. The other, of course, damage that happens not only to the kid and their development, but parents can go into burnout. Mm-hmm. You're using a lot of resources to accomplish very little. It's the same thing as if you drive your car at 6,000 RPMs in neutral. You're not getting any place, but you're burning a lot of gas and burning up your engine, and your engine's starting to run pretty hot. So, you know, you're putting a lot of energy into something that's not productive. And parents, particularly these days, have limited amounts of energy. I mean, they get up, they commute, they go to work, they come home, there's chores and responsibilities and the parenting functions. And if you're putting all your energy into something that's not giving you returns, you've got a lot of responsibility and no power, you're going to burn out. So the impact on kids, the impact on parents, and the impact on the identified patient is all quite profound.
All right. Well, share now, you said ring up the part in regards to the gap. So share with us a little bit about that.
Okay. Well, this is an important part of making sure that this shifting from consequences to privileges becomes a functionally different thing, becomes a very different animal. What happens is, let's just say you switch to privileges and you'll say, okay, you've lost your privileges. And then the kid will say, well, what do I need to do to get them back? When do I get them back? And you'll say, well, I don't know when you get them back, when you earn them. He says, okay, what do I have to do to earn them? And you'll say, well, that's a good question. I'm not sure I really know the answer to that, but I'll know it when I see it. But what it's really going to take is you being sincere. I need to know that this is not going to be my job to make you behave in the future, that it's going to be your job to make you behave. So I need you to come back and let me know what you're going to do to make that change for yourself, and you're going to have to let me know that you have made it and how I'm going to know that you've made it, because I don't know. And then the kid will object, well, if you don't tell me what I'm supposed to do, how am I supposed to do it? And the answer is, I don't really know, but I do know this, that you're capable of being a thoughtful, sincere kid. And when you're thoughtful and sincere, and you show me that you're thoughtful and sincere and committed, and you're, what you're telling me is real, it's just not to get what you want, but it's to be different. And when you choose to be different, and you communicate and show me that you've chosen to be different, then I'll know. So the gap is what I call that period of time when it's almost like we're saying to the kid, what's the sound of one hand clapping? It's like they really have to reconceptualize what's going on here, that this isn't a matter of punishments and rewards that their parent is setting up. It's really about them learning and growing and taking responsibility for who they are in the world and how they're presenting themselves to their parents. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And along those lines, we have another message coming in. And this one reads, can you explain a few of the steps we could learn in resolving the struggle, which is an understatement for what we are experiencing with our 14-year-old son? His anger issues are beginning to make us fear that he may hurt someone because of his ever-increasing short fuse. And this is from Bob in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, Bob, you know, that is an excellent question. And what's telling to me in your question is that his anger is getting worse. It's not getting better. So that's a clue that the way in which this is being addressed in the family is now part of the problem. Now it is part of the control battle. So what we're going to want to do is identify that anger and that way of your son dealing with his feelings as one of the things he's going to need to own and take some responsibility for and show us some work with before he's going to get his privileges. So what is anger? Anger is a way to express frustration or disappointment or to get what you want. That's what anger is. Anger is what we often call a cover emotion. It's something that we engage because we're unhappy with something, and then we use our anger to express our unhappiness. So he's going to need a more sophisticated toolkit, and that's one of the things the kids are doing during their adolescence. They're learning to understand their emotions, understand which they are, and understand healthy ways to deal with them. And we're going to want to make it real clear to your son that being threatening with his anger is abusive, it's hostile, it's inappropriate, and it starts in the family and it can end up out in the world. And that's going to get him in trouble with the law, it's going to get him in trouble in relationships, and out of your duty as a parent, you're going to want to help him learn better skills for managing his emotions. And he has to be a willing student if he's going to have his privileges.
All right. And for anybody, if you want to be able to either get the book or to get more information, to be able to listen to your blog, and Neil, correct me, they're going to go to neildbrown.com, and that's N-E-I-L, D as in David, Brown, B-R-O-W-N.com. Mm-hmm. Is there any other things going on? Is there seminars coming up or anything that where people can learn more about you and what you're doing?
I have a TEDx presentation this coming up this Saturday in Salinas. That's TEDx Salinas might be where you'd find that.
Okay.
And then you can find my TEDx talk. You'll be able to find my TEDx talk on the TEDx website. And I also am host of the Healthy Family Connections podcast. And that's my YouTube site for that. But if you go to my website, that will lead you there, and you'll get my weekly podcasts. And they're short. I try to keep them under 10 minutes, so it fits into people's lifestyles.
They're busy schedule, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I try to take, and then what I'll do is I answer questions that come in from my listeners. So I'd be more than happy to take your questions and then respond to it on my podcast. And if you want to reach out to me and want to talk with me, you can do that through my website as well.
That would be great. And is it also on iTunes?
Yes, on iTunes. Yeah, okay. It's a nice iTunes site. Yes.
Okay. So again, so everybody, you can go to iTunes and you can look up Healthy Family Connections podcast, and you can click on it, and iTunes will send it to you every day, every week, or whenever it comes out, they'll send it to you. It'll be waiting for you on your phone. It's the easiest thing ever. So, that's just one of the many ways in which you can get really valuable information and have it waiting for you. So, Neil, thank you so much for coming on. This has been wonderful. For everybody out there, please thank you for listening, and please be sure to put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday when we are joined by the author of Power Beyond Measure, 3 Steps to Claim Your Power Within for a Happy and Healthy Life. And again, please go to your Facebook, your Twitter. Remember to stop by our page. Check out some of our latest posts. If you like them, please like us and continue to spread the word. For everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to